Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Redbox Media. That's right. Here we go again, kids. Episode 150. Da-da-da-da. We need like some fireworks. You know, some kind of like, I just really want to be David Letterman. I just really want to have sound effects and fireworks. And I think I need a Paul Schaefer. I need a band leader over here. You know, maybe Kevin Clay could be my Paul Schaefer. Kev, you want to be my Paul Schaefer? Where I could be like, Soupy, play me something. You know, that would be awesome. Oh, so 150 episodes. I am amazed. I said yesterday that I was not amazed and that I was amazed at my non-amazement. But today, I'm amazed. I've done 150 episodes of it. I've done this before. I've said this before. Let me take a drink of coffee here. I mean, if you knew how hard it was for me to do 150 of anything, like if I could, the time that it takes me to do this show, if I had worked out for that time or prepared better meals during that time for 150 times in a row, like I would be married right now. I would be thin. And I would be married probably to a supermodel or something. A Catholic supermodel with a PhD in philosophy. That's who I would be married to right now. Anyway, so 150 episodes. I want to say that this is as good a milestone as any. You know. This has been a really positive force in my life, this show. The thing that I do, for better or worse, on this show is something that I do naturally. This kind of taking what I read and what I see and what's going on, kind of weaving it together somehow into sometimes finding a bead or a thread on a commonality. It's just something that I do. It's just something I've always done, and it's become more and more who I am. And most of the time, you know, let's just revisit this. You know, the show is called The Counterposition. That's because this style of commentary that I do is the kind of commentary and the kind of conversations and stuff that take place with me all the time, because I spend a lot of time working behind a counter, pulling espresso shots, steaming milk, making manual brew coffee, and just like talking to people. I've been a barista or in the coffee industry or studying the coffee industry to open a shop or something. I mean, for I think 23 years is what I figured out. I mean, definitely by the early 90s, I was like subscribing to coffee magazines and talking a lot about going to coffee houses and studying them with the intent of opening one. So I've been actively working almost daily as a barista off and on since the mid 90s for sure. And so it's just that my entire education, my entire education in philosophy, and then my entire education in the great books all took place in the context of this. And so this conversation that is small talk, but it's also not small talk, and it's important small talk and light big talk, or big, you know, kind of heavy serious talk in a light environment, and just, you know, that where anything can come up in, it's just, I don't know how to describe, this is how I've lived my life. And so when this came, who would have thought? Well, I take that back. To be honest, several friends of mine over the course of my life for the last 15 years probably have said, you should do Catholic radio. Why don't you do Catholic radio? And quite honestly, I would go listen to Catholic radio, and it was very, very structured and very catechetical, or it was very much open lines, and it was questions about canon law and theology, and none of that is what I was interested in. And so I became convinced that what I could do would just never find a home, because the Catholic radio world and the just wasn't interested at all. They just wouldn't be interested in what I do, and I wouldn't be interested in what they do. And the mainstream radio world would be like, "Guy's way too abstract, and he's way too interested in religion and philosophy." And they would never be. They want me to scream and shout bullet points, or, you know, make vulgar jokes to sell more cars for our advertisers. I mean, I just wasn't even interested in that. But I've always listened to kind of talk radio. I used to be a big Limbaugh listener, not so much anymore. I'm from Rush Limbaugh's hometown. At least my family, my mom's family, is from down there, and I've lived in Cape Girardeau for quite a long time. And I've listened to a lot of talk radio. When I lived in California, I listened to KFI, AM KFI, quite a bit, John and Ken show, and some of those evening shows. And I've been a giant fan for a long time of Coast to Coast AM. And just all the weirdness that happens with, and just what a master interviewer and kind of Art Bell is. And when George Norrie took over, just the way he handles even the weirdest callers with just such aplomb and such kindness and mercy. You know, I used to jokingly say, I'm like, you want to make me happy in this world? You know, give me the like cable Catholic radio shift from midnight to 3 a.m. and let me do whatever I want. And it's funny. And then probably a couple years ago, I sat down and I had been doing Strengths Finder, and then I did I've talked about this a lot on the show, but I'll just recap it. And I did Marcus Buckingham's book, Now Go Put Your Strengths to Work. Or Go Put Your Strengths to Work, I think it's called. It really a spectacular process he lays out, where you just kind of figure, you record all the activities and things you did that just made you just hate life. And you record all the stuff that you say, that was awesome. When do I get to do that again? And then you figure out what are the commonalities between those things, and you start figuring out kind of what you're amazing at, what you can do with near perfect precision every time, come away really enthused. And I came up with something along the lines of like looking at a bunch of disparate input from business and philosophy and theology and goings on and politics and all the nature, and finding kind of patterns and commonalities between them, and seeing kind of a thread, you know, finding patterns and talking about them. And I remember thinking to myself, there is no way on earth unless I could just be some weird author that writes all this stuff down, and people, I mean, there's just no way that I will ever make anything remotely resembling a living in that way. And it's funny, when this show was offered to me, I was like, okay, I don't know, you know, and what I'm going to do. And so, you know, the first few episodes, for about the first 10, kind of off and on, I was kind of doing my greatest hits, all my big ideas, all the themes, and all the stories. And then, you know, I kind of got in the commentary and stuff. And then now it's like, you know, I've always intended to make this a much more interview-driven show. And it's just, I work a full-time job, and I have an apostolate that is also kind of a consulting firm, kind of it does two different things. So, you know, say my schedule is so bizarre. So getting taking the time to make contact and get things set up and get technology and everything. That's the next direction I want to go, is really get my distant interview tech down so I can start having some really interesting conversations. So I think the next 50 episodes, the next 50 to 100 episodes will be a little more interview driven. And then after that, I think where we're heading eventually is at least some days of the week, opening up the lines and getting some calls. And you'll get a chance to actually start talking to me. And that'll bring in a whole new element to the show. And I'm really excited about that. At first, I was kind of worried about it because I had to build a following that wouldn't call me and ask me a bunch of cantaloupe questions, because this is not what I do. We're trying to do something different in Catholic media. We're trying to do something other than, oh, I'm Catholic and you're listening to me on the soundbox, so I evidently couldn't explain why your grandma couldn't get an annulment. I mean, it's like, I have no idea why your grandma couldn't get an annulment. I am confused and frustrated with that whole concept and the whole idea. Not that I don't understand theology. I have a degree that's largely in theology, but it's just not that kind of theology. And for better or worse, I'm kind of an idealist, and so I don't live in those practical kind of aspects of theology and canon law and all that. And that seems to be what everybody wants to ask about when they call Catholic radio. So anyway, I just want to say, as we close down this first segment, that I am really, really, really appreciate all of you who listen to this show. And that has been a positive force in my life, and you have been a positive force in my life. All right, let's head off to the break, and I'll shut up about this stuff when we get back. You're listening to The Counter Position. Be right back.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
Welcome back to The Counter Position. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right, well, so I didn't talk about this yesterday. I kind of heard it, but, you know, these weird rumors go around the internet and gain steam, and I'd been busy, so I hadn't really seen any of the real news sites or anything, but I guess at this point, it's more than confirmed, and Prince was found dead. Now, man, there's so much to talk about with this, with Prince. I mean, Prince was a celebrity, a man I never met, a man from a different generation, a man in his mid-50s from Minnesota who was a professional musician, a black man. I am a white man from a different generation, from a small town in southern Missouri. And I have done coffee for a living and everything. And I don't know this man whatsoever. So what in the world? Why would this man, other than, why would this man's death affect me in some way? Why would I notice it in any meaningful way other than, any more than I would notice people that died in the earthquakes in Japan or in Ecuador recently? Or, so I guess there was another big bombing a couple days ago that I kind of heard about after the fact. It's like in Jerusalem, a bus was bombed or something. It's like, why would Prince Rogers Nelson's death, a funk musician, a multi-instrumentalist musical auteur from a gritty urban part of Minnesota, I mean, why would that affect me? And he said, well, because of pop culture. Okay, yeah, pop culture. Oh, well, that's fine. That's true. I mean, but, you know, David Bowie died. And, I mean, we talked about it on the show. Paul McGusker and I were on the show talking about it. I wish I could say I was cool enough that David Bowie was like a part of my musical life growing up, really. But by the time I was in the 80s, I mean, there's a few, you know, he was in that, you know, China Doll phase and all. David Bowie, I mean, he was one of the guys that had videos on MTV when I was in high school. I'm too young to, when he was doing Ziggy Stardust and all, I was in elementary school. I mean, I don't remember that. And I was more interested in hard music by the time I was watching him. He just didn't affect me. But Prince, I don't know how to describe it. When Purple Rain, 1999, you know, and that record, I guess that was the first record was called, the one that had 1999 on it, had Little Red Corvette. Those were just, there was just a sound that I'd never heard before. I mean, the guy was kind of, he had like this Jimi Hendrix kind of aspect to him, where he was, it was funky. It was very funky, but it was hard. I mean, there was like hard guitars and guitar solos and all that. And it just sounded like something I just never hadn't heard, you know. And then when Purple Rain came out, and that whole hot, super high concept, you know, kind of like, and he did this film kind of show, almost kind of like establishing his brand. Now, it was pretentious and weird and artsy and had nothing to do with my day-to-day life in a really small ex-mining town in southern Missouri. It meant nothing to me, but it was almost like, oh, wow, you can have kind of a persona. You can have a brand. You can live in a way that's kind of intentional, or so. I don't know how to describe it. I mean, I was in seventh grade. I'm a grown ass man now, looking back on trying to figure out what in the world Prince was to me in seventh, eighth grade. But I know it meant enough to me to where I can remember buying in a thrift store a purple trench coat that I found. And I can remember I can remember a very particular night having my hair kind of gelled all up and kind of cool looking, and I had an earring, and I put in a dangly cross earring in my left ear, and I had on like I don't know what pants I had on, but I had on kind of a long kind of print shirt and some boots, and I had this trench coat on, this purple trench coat, and I found some black leather gloves with the fingers cut out of them. Total 80s look, right? And I put this on. I'm like probably 13 years old probably. And I remember I went to the movies in Bon Terre, Missouri, and we were hanging out outside, and there was a really pretty girl, and she said, "Oh, you look like Prince." I was just like, I had to like try hard not to cry from being so happy that someone would think I look like Prince. You know, he just kind of was this weird symbol of like living as this kind of intentional artist and kind of creating this whole reality around you. And I was, how to say it? I guess I'm doing like self therapy on the air. Like, you know, when Prince came on the scene, I was in junior high. And my mom and dad had just gotten divorced, or were in the process of divorcing. So, yeah, I guess, I don't know. Yeah, that's, Prince hit the scene literally as Prince's fame and my puberty hit this world at the exact same time. So maybe that's what it is. Maybe somehow listening, you know, I mean, I read Kevin Smith wrote a Facebook post about this, and he said that his high school girlfriend turned him on to Prince, and so all of his original like makeout sessions were to Purple Rain or something. And I kind of relate to that. I mean, right about the time that I went from worrying about whether or not I was good at sports for the sake of like being friends with the right dudes to everything revolving around what girls thought and what, and like, you know, girls. Right about that transition is when Prince happened and my parents got divorced. So there's something about, I don't know, whenever your parents get divorced, it's like your family gets ripped apart and you have this, you're kind of on your own in some new way. Both physically, you're alone probably more often. And your identity as your place in this trinity that was this family, you know, is kind of redefined because now you're kind of floating free between these two points, right? And that happened to me right about the time that I was really emerging as an individual person and, you know, kind of, you know, in the whole libido thing and hormones and all that kicking in. And right about that time, the soundtrack to that thing, the soundtrack to me trying to figure out what in the world was going on with my life, what in the world was going on with all these emotions and this internal life, why in the world was I so moved by the feminine, why in the world was I so worried about what other people thought about me, why in the world was I so like feeling some weird desire to do something or be something or become something. All of a sudden, the soundtrack to that moment in my life was largely made up of Prince. I must have worn out two cassettes of Purple Rain. And so I don't know what it is about art, what it is about pop culture that these things become the soundtrack to these moments. And sometimes a moment in your life coincides with a certain artist and a certain thing that they were trying to express. And maybe just even by coincidence of the moment, that thing ends up taking on more meaning because it hits you in some way. I don't know. It's funny. I don't know. Maybe not everyone lives like that. Maybe not everybody was raised like that. You know, I have a really close friend who just doesn't know anything about any pop music at all. Was raised on, you know, classical music and jazz and stuff, and was raised completely inside the faith. And that's great, and I think that's probably the better way to go. But I was raised in a family going through divorce and trying to make out with girls in eighth grade, listening and trying to be cool by looking like and listening to Prince. And so this whenever I heard Prince died, this hit me, you know. So this, even look at this. I'm not talking about Prince. Like I said, I don't know Prince. I mean, you look, it seems like he kind of promoted a certain kind of artistic hedonism for a long time. Then he kind of took his place as the crazy auteur uncle of the funk and rock world. And everyone, he didn't have mass commercial success for a long time, but he would just sell shows out, and his live shows were just so incredibly well rehearsed, and he's just a consummate professional that just had this huge impact on everyone. He's kind of like the Velvet Underground, where it's like when you look at who was actually into them, it was very few people, but they all went and started bands. And Prince was kind of that on a pop culture level, where everyone knew about him, but once he faded out, you know, only a certain small amount of people were into him still. But you just see so many people who have done so much in this world, and they were influenced by him. So anyway, I'm abandoning what I want to talk about today. I've got a couple of new ideas after this segment. So let's go to the break and let's pick it up on the other side. You're listening to The Counterposition.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Redbox Media. Yeah, I'm gonna punt on some of the stuff I was gonna talk about. Maybe we'll find a beat on it and come back to some of it. I had a couple things that I wanted to discuss, but I think this is interesting. I want to, before we move on, I want to just kind of talk about, I want to talk about Prince, the man, as best I understand. I don't know much about him. I just, you know, you see him go through this phase of kind of this really artistic hedonism, right? But this promotion of like another way of living, he's off in this strange place being really artistic, and he's very sexual and he's kind of funky, but he's kind of strangely ambiguously feminine. He doesn't try to dress, but he's kind of macho. He just like embraces full on, you know, young black guy machismo in a way that people were kind of pulling away from at that time, but at the same time not dressing and acting like a little feminine and stuff. He just made his own weird brand where you're just like, man, that guy's freaky. I mean, he's a freaky guy. He just does freaky stuff. Well, I bet he has this like a crazy freaky mansion with all kinds of freaky stuff going on. It's like everybody, but he was a very, very conscious professional. And I remember seeing him interviewed by, I can't remember what it was, who it was, but it was another great, it was another big, giant star in that kind of R&B rock world. And they were talking about listening to, you know, watching these modern singing competitions, like, you know, American Idol and The Voice and stuff. And he goes, is it just me or I can't watch those. I just end up spending all of my time thinking about how I would have arranged that completely differently. And he spends all his time hearing the arrangement and how the band is set up and how the sound is set up and stuff. This guy was a really consummate professional. He played just every instrument known to man, and some of them on like a virtuoso level, and was a performer of power in a way that like you hadn't seen since like James Brown or something. I mean, the guy just, he would just work a stage and a crowd like in a way that art form, that craft that is pop music or soul music, R&B soul music. I mean, it's hard to describe what he was, you know. We kind of promoted this kind of a hedonism, you know, that was his kind of brand for a long time. And then he got out of the spotlight, and it seems like his brand turned more real. It turned more into who he was, where he was the artist, he was the performer, and it was more about him being that. Now, he still worked his vibe and he still worked his brand, but after the whole, like, you know, he changed his name to a symbol for a while, and everyone started saying the artist formerly known as Prince. It's like he was almost like he played, it's funny, you want to call him pretentious. And he was, but he wasn't pretending to do anything, because he really was that good. I mean, he really was this crazy pop auteur. I mean, he really was this insane. So just incredibly good and incredibly interesting and incredibly weird and deep, you know. So you kind of want, you don't want to use the word pretentious, because he wasn't pretending to do anything, you know. But that being said, I mean, he definitely was high concept to a challenging level. But you saw later in his life, he had a much more spiritual turn. Now, his spirituality and kind of that whole thing had always been a part. He basically, if you wanted to describe his thing, and maybe that's why it was so powerful to me when I was in junior high and kind of emerging as an independent person, is that it kind of mixed sex and religion in a way. It was a passionate way of living that had a spiritual aspect. I mean, the way he recorded and some of the, you know, just some of the lyrics and stuff. That was, he obviously had an influence from growing up in church or something. And so he took, it was, his music was erotic, but spiritually erotic as well. That it was spiritually passionate and being caught up, you know, kind of in that nature of the moment that pop music can move us into. But towards the end of his life, he became more overtly spiritual. I think he became either Jehovah's Witness or Seventh-day Advent. I think it was Jehovah's Witness. I guess that's maybe how he was raised. And he started going back to church. And from what I understand, there was a lot of it. Some of his more sexual songs he wouldn't play anymore. And he had a move towards God and towards... And it seems like the one thing that I've seen a lot of quotes from him floating around the internet. And one theme from all his posts being giant life was gratitude. He seemed like he knew that his multi-instrumentalism, his ability to perform, his ability to understand technically performance and recording and all that, and all the artists that he helped bring up and influence, he seemed like he understood that, but it seems like this great, audacious, big kind of over-the-top rock star that he was gained some real humility that can only come from and be kind of expressed in real gratitude. And so it seems like, I don't know where he was in his life. I don't know what he was like morally. I don't know where he was theologically. I have no idea. It just seemed like the trajectory of his life was a very Augustinian kind of, like, that it was embodied kind of a restlessness that he kind of tried to embody, a restlessness that came out in spiritual longing and in sexual hedonism. And then it became more high concept and kind of pretentious, but just really high concept to the point that, like, people just didn't understand what he was doing half the time. But he seemed like he was restless. And when I saw Prince interviewed a few times, like later in his life, there was still a passion there, but it seemed like he was more grounded. It seemed like he was more, that he wasn't as restless. It seemed like he'd settled into who he was, and some version of who he used to be was part of who he was, but he kind of figured out who he was. And, you know, Like St. Augustine so famously said, that God has made us for himself and our hearts are restless until they rest in thee, he says, you know. And I think that that's kind of everyone's biography in a sense, right? Is confusion and passion and longing and trying to make something of what you're given. And then kind of frustration with that project. And so you reinvent that project a couple times. And then at some point, you kind of become who you are. And if you really, really become who you are, if you become really, really, really who you were made to be, then you end up a saint. Most of us end up somewhere between brash, over-the-top, hedonistic longing and saint. But I'm going to say, just observing from the outside, that seemed to be the trajectory that man's life was on. And so, I hold out a lot of hope for old Prince. I think guy played a huge influence, good and bad, on a lot of people in this world. But I think the guy lived kind of a weird, how to say it, it's kind of like the human condition and the human autobiography, the human biography, the human story, if you know, a person story, kind of like 2:11. When he was rebellious, he was really rebellious. When he was sexual, he was really, really sexual. When he was religious and longing, he was really, really religious and longing. And then that all kind of began to coalesce into an identity that seemed to have a deep amount of gratitude for the trajectory of the process and for who he was becoming and who he was made to be. So, you know, man, rest in peace, Prince. You know, I say we pray for him. Pray for him. And if everything works out, you know, maybe one day he'll be praying for us. See, they would not let me do this on Catholic radio in the early 90s. Going back to segment one. All right. You know, I'm gonna pick up that thread from segment two and talk about this weird interface between moments and artists in the last section. So you're listening to The Counterposition. I'm your host, Andrew Whalen.
Breadbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
This is my mistake. Let me make it good. I raised the wall.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whalen, here on Breadbox Media. All right, so to my great surprise, my first little bullet point on my notes today to mention that Prince died and say a few things about the influence of Prince in my world has turned into an entire show. And so I guess the rest of these bullet points are going to be episode 151, or they're going to go into the dustbin of history. One of the two. So going back to where I was at on the end of segment two before, I didn't want to just continually going really high concept and talk about the nature of art and nature of pop music and how it affects us in our lives and not acknowledge that an individual human person had died. I wanted to talk about him, not his impact on me. You know, and so I just wanted to put that in, I was afraid that I would get lost in this conversation I want to have now, and we would get to the end of the show, and I'd never actually talk about this actual man that died. But so we were talking about, it seems to me that there, you know, when I look back over moments in my life, I think that everyone, when you live in, and this is a modern thing, right? This is something that's a brand new thing. It probably started, I don't know, I probably guess probably in the 50s. By the time that, you know, radios were in cars and music was ubiquitous, and the soundtrack of our lives was what was on the radio. And then that evolved in the 80s, and it was what was on the radio and what was on MTV. And then with cassette players and then CDs, you know, and then the Walkman, once you could put some batteries into a little thing and carry it around with you and listen to that cassette, then things became more the soundtrack. And so, you know, in the 80s, the way I lived, I mean, I would get up in the morning and there would be music on. I would get in the car to go to school and there'd be music going. I might be listening to music while I was getting ready. And then, you know, you'd be listening to music in between classes. You'd be like listening to music in your car afterwards. We would go skateboarding, and someone would pull their car up, open the doors, turn the stereo on, and we'd be listening to music. Or we'd be on my ramp in the backyard, skateboarding my little mini ramp, and there'd be a boombox playing. So when I think of this, I'm from a generation, and I think even more now, you see these kids, I mean, you know, back in 2009, 2010, I had a coffee house near high school in California, and there'd be these four little girls sitting on two couches facing each other, and they'd each have one earbud in, and they'd be talking to each one of them would be listening to different music, and they'd be having a conversation, and then of course they'd be texting a secondary conversation underneath that conversation to each other and other people around, which is just bizarre. Now they're probably all doing all that and Instagramming and tweeting or Snapchatting each other, you know, the whole time. It's just, that's a whole nother story. I think we really missed something about getting, how to say it, really being present, but that's a whole different story, and I've been down that rabbit trail many times. But, you know, my generation was the first generation where music was just really ubiquitous. You did not need a record player. You didn't even need a radio. There was enough devices to keep you in music all the time. And so because of that, we kind of had this soundtrack going, you know? And so it was pretty funny. I put this on Facebook the other day that I was in Trader Joe's, and Rocket by Herbie Hancock came on, and I had to like fight my body because I wanted to start breakdancing. Like there was like, I could feel muscles moving, because when I was part of a breakdancing group back in junior high, I had a routine that I had devised to that song, and I had practiced it so much that after all these years, I could feel my muscles wanting to start kind of twitch and turn in those directions on those beats and stuff, because it was so written into me, right? Somewhere back in my brain, there are still weak but still there synaptic connections between nerve endings in my muscles, synaptic connections in the gray matter in my head, and a memory of dancing in this particular song. It's just like, it's amazing, right? That should be both amazing and frightening, is how we're built, you know. But so you look back on these, and so I think of, you know, the all those, you know, the soundtrack of like junior high and listening to like all this hip hop and wanting to break dance and all that, and then Prince being in the middle of it. And then I think of later on, just like, you know, skateboarding and listening to the Descendants and Black Flag and DRI and all this like 80s punk rock and hardcore and you know, and the Cult. I mean, every time I think about skating a ramp, I think of the Cult, Electric, that record, because there was just a phase of our lives where we were just like listening to that, was just always on the boombox when we were skating that ramp in my backyard. And, you know, and so I've talked about the Prince moment, but I say, I remember when I was, but the summer between my junior and senior year in high school, I had, I opened a skateboard shop, and I had no idea what I was doing. No idea. I just knew that I've talked about this before. It was my latest attempt at this big idealistic vision of the ultimate clubhouse in my mind, where I just wanted to create a place where people could come. And I definitely identified so much with me being the person that provided the place that I got very proud about it. And I had nothing. I mean, I was a part of a broken family, and I was coming home sometimes and finding the electric shut off and stuff. We were struggling as at times. And we managed to scrape together enough money and open this little small business. And I really invested my entire identity into it. And I became very arrogant because I was trying to tell myself that I was something better than what I thought I was and what everybody kind of had treated me as. And so that reaction happened, and people that were my friends supposedly robbed me and stole stuff from me two different times and destroyed that small business. And I just was ostracized and vandalized and all my stuff and everything. And it just destroyed me my senior year in high school. And I remember at the end of my senior year, I had a bona fide, honest to goodness, full on nervous breakdown. In the sense of I just like collapsed. I was up all night talking to my mom, and I didn't remember anything that I'd said the next day. And I remember the next day, she wanted to get me out of town. And so we drove to St. Louis, and we went to, I was so obsessed with getting my shop open again because it had gotten closed. And so we went up to Altered Skates, to Glenn Stalling's shop on the U-City Loop, and I got me some Greek food and all that. And I got in the car, and I just couldn't stop crying. And I remember we went to some little music store that was over in Flat River, Missouri, and I she went in and let me pick anything I wanted. So I got R.E.M. Green had just came out. And I bought R.E.M. Green, and I listened to it in the car on the way up there, just crying the whole time. And I listened to it all the way home. And I ended up kind of being sent, so to speak, to stay with my grandparents down in Jackson, Missouri, to kind of get me out of that context and away from those faces and all that for a summer. And I met all these people that I used to skateboard with down there, Gabe and Jason and Ryan, all these different people. And I just skateboarded all summer and delivered pizza in my car. It's my first year out of school and my first summer not facing high school or something in the fall. And I didn't know what to do with myself. I had gone just a little nuts. I mean, I really should have been in counseling. I really should have been given some therapy or something. But that just wasn't how things were done back then. And it ended up with my big religious conversion happening in the fall. But that summer, I just listened to R.E.M. Green on repeat. And I tell you what, to this day, when I hear a lot of those songs, it can completely transform my interior world. So when God forbid, in several years, if I'm still doing this show, and they find Michael Stipe dead, it's going to be an interesting show that day. Because that's one of those moments. And I could go on and on, man. Over the Rhine, I've talked about a lot in the early 90s when I was kind of coming of age as an adult. And all these different moments, these soundtracks. So, I don't know. I thought his death was a good reason to maybe talk about the nature of how our soundtracks get embedded in us. But kind of a weird show. Thanks for playing along. I appreciate it. Let's pull the plug, pop the cork on another episode of The Counterposition. Thanks for coming out.